Mr. Rhodes is alive! Here, look who it is!
Sherlock Holmes is probably the greatest man alive. The greatest man of 1893 or 4 or 5. The greatest man of 1896 or 7 or 8. And other men with claims of fame will simply have to wait.
And who's the reason they will have to write?
Sherlock Holmes, without a doubt, the greatest man on earth.
He's so much more than anyone else that nobody knows his worth.
Success can only follow him no matter where he goes.
The one and only Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes the Musical is a musical based on characters created by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, with music, lyrics, and book by Leslie Bricus.
Leslie is probably most famous for the score for the film Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
He also did Goldfinger. Goldfinger.
Really?
Well, he did the lyrics. So what Leslie Bricus, his work with Anthony Newley, which is, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, but also Stop the World, yes. I Want to Get Off, and Roar of the Grease, Paint the Smell of the Crowd, both of which were big hits on the West End and moderate hits in the U.S. But that's what he's most famous for, is those three scores, which, all co-written with Newley. But what he's also probably known for, if not famous for, is that he did a lot of lyric work for, like, themes to movies. He did the Goldfinger theme. He did the lyrics for the Superman theme in that one bit where, like, Lois Lane, they're flying and she's like singing this poem along with the lyrics. He wrote the music and lyrics for the Dr. Doolittle movie, which then, when it got translated to the stage in the 90s, he did the book for that as well. Similarly, situation with Scrooge the Musical, from which is a movie first and then became a stage musical. He did both of those. I believe that Sherlock Holmes the Musical is his first time writing music and lyrics for a score for something that was for the stage first and not for film.
He also did Le Jazz Hot from Victor Victoria.
He also has no Tony Awards, but he does have an Oscar for Talk to the Animals from Dr. Doolittle.
Love that.
Oh, and he also has an adapted score Oscar for Victor Victoria.
We love that. So, other fast facts about Sherlock Holmes the Musical. The musical opened on the 22nd of October, 1988, at the Northcote Theatre in Exeter, England, and ran for a limited season of 5 weeks. It then transferred to the Cambridge Theatre in London's West End from April to July of 1989. Was definitely not popular, had a lot of negative reviews, and actually during this time, there were a lot of public transit strikes in the area, which actually made it pretty hard for people to get to this musical, which is also why it didn't run that long. The musical stars Ron Moody as Sherlock Holmes. Ron Moody, known
from Oliver.
From Oliver, yes.
From the film
of
Oliver.
And then the Patti LuPone revival in 83.
Yes.
And then Derek Waring played Dr. Watson. The cast also include Liz Robertson, who is known today as playing Madame Giry in the original cast of Love Never Dies, and was in the 25th anniversary of Phantom of the Opera as Madame Giry with Sierra Boggess and Ramin Kamlou.
As Bella Moriarty in this, if you didn't say that, sorry.
Or Bella Spellgrove, one or the other.
Right.
Like I said, this production was not received well, had largely negative reviews. And then in 1993, a revival occurred at the Old Vic Theatre. It featured a completely new cast, as well as three new musical numbers. Besides those changes, the revival remained fairly similar to the original production. Similarly to the original production, it did also not fare well and had really bad reviews.
There have been a lot more attempts to revise this one than the other one. We mentioned earlier that it's under a different title now, so I assume they've continued to make changes with it over the years.
Yes, in 2013, Bricus worked with a theater company and set it within a Victorian music hall. The show is now called The Revenge of Sherlock Holmes, and this revised version includes never previously performed material and actually opened to more critical acclaim. So that is the more recent one. Is probably the best version of this show.
That version, The Revenge of Sherlock Holmes, is the version that is currently licensed by Concord Theatrical. So if you're performing it, you'll be doing that one. The script that we are working with is the original published version, which I believe follows the 1989 West End production.
And then to further complicate matters, the cast recording is from 1993, which is a different version as well, so the songs are in a completely different order.
Are you sure about that? The version I'm looking at is definitely the 1989 OLC.
Wait, so
Did we listen to different versions?
I'm on Spotify. There's a 93 version with orange and white, like, typeface, like, white background.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know they made a 93 recording. I just have the 80. I have the 89.
Ah, interesting. Well, yeah, so, okay, so the 93 version on Spotify, the songs are in a completely different order. In some interesting ways, like, well, we'll get into it a little bit as we go along.
Yeah, we'll specify.
This, in a weird way, this one sort of opens where the last one left off.
Yeah, I mean, the beginning of this one is a more traditional version of the Reichenbach fall. We start with Holmes and Moriarty. It's all silhouetted, like, it's very intentionally, you know, you're not actually seeing what's going on. But you have Holmes and Moriarty, they do their big fight. I imagine a lot of this dialogue is directly out of the book.
Yes, it is.
And then they fall, and we go into the most, you know, high-octane version opening of this song, which is the lament version of Sherlock Holmes, where everything is kind of dour and in minor key.
This is, I mean, talking about the evolution of musical theater, this is a sequence, right? Like, this isn't just like a scene where we're planted. Mm-hmm. We're moving from location to location over a long sequence that is, acts as the prologue to this show. Mm-hmm. It isn't for several pages that we get to scene one. So everyone is mourning, especially the Baker Street Irregulars. Watson starts narrating, which makes sense, but I'm not sure they keep doing this throughout the show.
No, I was really hoping that would be an ongoing thing, because it felt like a cool way to frame it. But no, he basically narrates in this opening sequence and then never again. But then, yeah, basically, you know, what you would imagine, like, a priest wanders in, and immediately, having read Baker Street, this priest wanders in, and I'm like, okay, so that's Holmes in disguise. That's obviously Holmes in disguise. But then it is, and then he reveals that he's alive. And then we go into Sherlock Holmes homecoming, you know, edition, where he walks outside, seemingly like Sherlock just walks outside completely, you know, not even thinking about the fact that he's allegedly dead and will be freaking people out if he just walks outside.
Well, you also skipped over him saving Watson's life. Homoerotically pins him to the chair twice, once to save his life and then a second time to show off his cool karate tricks.
And then a third time to give him a little smooch.
Right.
Yeah.
Because with the downfall of Moriarty, he's trying to round up Moriarty's gang and specifically Moran. Like, both musicals begin with Moran trying to shoot one of the two of them and being apprehended.
Yeah. In the opening bit with Moriarty, Holmes briefly mentions that he... I'm going to read directly out of the script. Are you aware that I have more than a smattering of baritsu, the Japanese system of wrestling, upon which I have written a slim monologue or monograph? And this shows up a couple of times where he just randomly drops that he knows a random, like, you know, martial arts technique and also has written about it.
What I love about this is, so the baritsu thing, or baritsu perhaps, is from the books. It's from the short story where the Reichenbach fall happens. But he mentions it in his letter to Watson about why he had to die, not out loud to Moriarty.
Yeah, in this one, he's basically that kid who's like, don't fuck with me. I got the power of God and anime on my side.
That's the vibe.
That's him. That's Holmes for you.
So anyway, he walks out after revealing that he's not dead, but he has been shot at now twice by Moran, presumably.
Which, if you're being shot out twice, the best thing to do is just go out into the open.
Well, the police have apprehended. He let the police know that Moran would try to shoot Watson. And I guess he was like, wait till he takes the shot and then get him.
Yeah.
Maybe...
let him take the shot, let me save my boyfriend's life, and then you can actually arrest him. Okay, so he's outside, he scares some people initially, but then not even the regulars. No, it's just a random crowd of people. Well, Watson starts it. Watson and Mrs. Hudson are singing about how cool it is that he's back. And then the whole company jumps in with this big rousing opening number where, I mean, the gist of this entire number is just, isn't Sherlock Holmes really cool?
I would like to point out, and it's especially when Mrs. Hudson first appears, that this is the first sign that the whole entire script is written in a Cockney accent.
Yes.
Yeah.
And all the songs are also written in a Cockney accent at many points.
Yep.
You mean phonetically, like they've written out the accent in the lines. And it's notable, too, because you literally have a line where Watson says Sherlock Holmes, and then Mrs. Hudson has written the next line as Sherlock Ohms with an apostrophe O at the front.
It's Mr. Ohms.
Mr. Ohms.
This whole piece definitely falls on the other side of the spectrum of, like, Sherlock Holmes' public figure. In a way that, like, in the first musical... Sherlock Holmes dies, and, like, the people who knew him are sad, in this one, it's like Sherlock Holmes dies and all of England mourns. And when he comes mm-hmm. back, we get a scene like two scenes from now where he's doing like a big deduction in public and everyone's going ooh and ah. So
yeah,
it's a very different Sherlock Holmes in that way.
I mean, again, I don't think that tone is something that you necessarily need to retain when you adapt something, but this is the bit where we get into this number and I'm like, okay, so this is a musical that happens to be about Sherlock Holmes. This is not trying to tell Sherlock Holmes through the medium of musical theater. This is, you wanted to write a big musical and Sherlock Holmes was available and free.
Yeah.
Well, so you wrote this big opening number, which, you know, where Sherlock doesn't even sing in it. Like, it's just people singing about how awesome he is.
It's like his Mickey Mouse Club theme song.
I mean, you're without even joking, yeah. Like, it's everyone just being like, Sherlock, let me read the actual lyrics of this because I think they're so funny. Sherlock Holmes is probably the greatest man alive, the greatest man of 1983 or 4 or 5, the greatest man of 1986 or 7 or 8, and other men with claim to fame will simply have to wait. Which is just like, it feels like he wrote the first half of that lyric and then thought about it and was like, I could probably just shove some more years in there.
Sherlock Holmes. Yeah. And Watson, Sherlock Holmes, and Watson.
So we cut to Baker Street.
Mm-hmm.
Sherlock Holmes is, like, upset to be retired, effectively. Sir Jevons has arrived at his door asking him to solve the case of the missing mace. Some sort of ceremonial mm-hmm. mace has gone missing. And
Holmes is like, boring.
Right. Can't do it, won't do it.
Yeah.
Not interested. He does use drugs in this version, because Watson comes home mm-hmm. and, like, finds the needle out.
Yes, he does.
He does use drugs in this version. But he's playing a song on his violin that this script helpfully indicates is called Missing Moriarty.
Which is literally just, it's him playing the melody of the song he is about to sing in-universe. Oh.
So this song, which was literally titled, is about how he is missing Moriarty, because he, actually, there's a quote here. This is from after the song. He says, I'm missing the best of myself. Only the perfect criminal merits the perfect detective. And he compares it to David and Goliath. He's like, David fought many battles, but he's only remembered for fighting Goliath. Which is an insane take on Sherlock's desire to have a legacy. In his farewell letter to Watson, he's like, I've done many great things. The greatest thing that I'll ever do is getting rid of Moriarty, but it'll be worth it, you know? And like this, he like cares about people, how people think about him. There's a vainness here that I think is not true to how the character appears in the books.
Yeah, yeah, it's just almost mm-hmm. like, I can't have any fun anymore, man.
Right. Whereas, like, Book Sherlock is like,
this man is dangerous, he needs to be put away, I need him gone.
Well, not even that, like, Book Sherlock is also like, your dog's missing in an interesting way, I'm there.
That know? Too, yeah.
Yeah.
And this Sherlock is like, and actually there literally are missing dogs, like a scene or two from here.
Yeah.
And he's not interested at first.
I mean, we talk about it. I talked about it earlier in the comparison, but I think it's even more apt here of, like, Holmes in this version is closer to Moriarty in the BBC one. Like, if he doesn't have a foil, he's bored.
Yeah.
Like, that's the main reason he's doing what he's doing. What the first thing of the many things in this musical that pissed me off was the bit in the song.
I want to get back to this.
Watson... Yeah, Watson just rolls through, basically just name drops, like, case after case after short story, and Holmes is just like, I'm bored those
better
now.
Better than that, it's this, like, post-Sweeney Todd, it's just a setting up a bunch of rhymes. Like, Watson names the cases, and then Sherlock finds some way to rhyme with the case that indicates that he's bored talking about it.
And some way to rhyme is really, I think, the strong thing here.
Oh, come now, Holmes. Your genius for solving the unsolvable is legendary. I mean, I'm speaking of the man who solved the Boscombe Valley mystery.
Well, that's history.
And the scandal in Bohemia.
Than which nothing could be seemier.
And the Red-Headed League.
A pathetic intrigue.
The man who solved the riddle of the engineer's thumb.
The mere memory makes me numb.
The solitary cyclist.
Is on my do not like list.
The solitary cyclist is on my do not like list. I want to throw things. It almost feels like this musical is kind of designed at every turn to anger people that like Sherlock Holmes stories.
Also, there's a weird, like, midway through the song, there's a weird diversion. And he goes, why am I missing Moriarty? Watson goes, very good question, Holmes. He says, I who have never missed anyone ever in my life, and certainly, absolutely, definitely not a wife. I have never missed a wife.
And Watson's like, absolutely not. Mind you, you've never had a wife.
This musical is also interested in Sherlock and love, I guess.
Yeah, this is a good example of how not to do that.
Yeah.
It's a really unsubtle way to, like, put that in there. Like, why are you thinking about that? Why is that on your mind in the middle of a song about Moriarty, for one thing?
Lady doth protest too much.
Lady doth protest at all.
So he sings this whole number about how he's sad that Moriarty's gone because he gave him a kind of purpose by having the perfect foil. And so then Watson says, like, oh, come on, take the case about the missing mace. I guarantee you could figure it out by 6 p.m.
Oh, wait.
And, you know,
There's also a weird bit of, like, casual sexism before we move on from this scene.
Oh, you mean the bit where he hates his wife?
No. Not where he hates his wife. There, Watson makes some reference to a revolver in a drawing room, and he says, on the contrary, the Sunday newspapers persuade me that revolvers in the drawing room are a constant feature of the British marriage. It's the only way men can have the last word. I mean, like, yes, Holmes is a misogynist, canonically, but it feels like the suffragette line where I'm like, are we supposed to be on his side here? Is this supposed to be, like, a joke for the men in the audience? Or is this, like, a character flaw? I'm not sure.
It's probably supposed to be a joke.
I mean, this is also 1989, right? This is, like, Thatcher era. So I don't know what the feminism conversation was like in England at this time, because this is the West End one. Yeah, it's a weird line. But anyway, Watson, you know, basically acting as caretaker for Holmes, is like, okay, let's get you out of the house, buddy. Let's go find this mace. I'll bet you a dinner that you can figure it out. But before they leave, he gets a card in the mail. He gets a playing card with an M, like, etched into it. And he immediately reads the Ace of Diamonds.
Because M plus Ace equals Mace.
Yeah. So then he walks out to London, and then the Wiggins shows up, and the Irregulars sing a song called London is London, which that is, there's the whole song in the title.
Actually, I like what the staging is described as, because the song is pretty boring. And I'm really glad that this show was eventually reinterpreted as taking place at a music hall, because a lot of these numbers would make much more sense. I mean, Sasha, compared it to Edwin Drood.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of that going on here.
Yeah, for sure.
But what I like about London is London is that the staging is described as, like, cutting against what the song is saying. Like, the lyrics are all cheerful, and then it's like all this crime and villainy is happening. Which is interesting because, you know, Sherlock isn't interested in dealing with petty crime, but we're shown pretty directly that there is a lot of petty crime going on. That, like, there is a need for...
somebody.
For something. Yeah. Yeah. We also meet Lestrade in this sequence, who just shows up to be like, London is corrupt, actually.
Yeah.
So Holmes kind of figures this out in a way. He's like, I know you have the thing in the bag.
Right. He shows up to a fish stall that he was guided to because of the playing card, and he gathers a crowd around and finds the mace and explains his deductions. Although he doesn't explain why he knew it was at a fish stall and nobody asks.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know how the card led him to the fishmonger, but he just kind of goes. And he points to a bag, and he's like, I'll take that one. And then the fishmonger pulls it out, and then he pulls the mace out of it. And the fishmonger gets arrested, but then he's like, well, no, he's fine. Like, he clearly he didn't steal it. He can't have stolen it. He just clearly, like, got this bag with a mace in it and didn't check.
Yeah, the fishmonger's exact quotation is, eh, what are you doing? I ain't done nothing. So, innocent.
God. It's really sort of anglophobic for the British people to write this.
Like I said, if you gave me these two and asked me which one was written by the Americans, I would have said this, because it feels so, even the song London is London, it just feels so much more, like, on the nose about, like, you know, it feels, you know, rude at times. Yeah. And to think that this played on the West End, I guess we do have musicals about America that are set in America that, like, you know, are all like, New York is the best city on earth. I don't know. It's just weird. It's a weird thing.
And then Holmes at the end of the scene is like, well, this could only be one person. Moriarty, live.
It's gotta be
Moriarty. He's alive.
And, well, he's not technically... I mean, he is wrong, but...
We cut to a London hotel room where we reveal
Mr. Moriarty had a missus.
Right.
And a daughter.
Maria Moriarty.
And another daughter who isn't on stage.
And, Miss Bella Moriarty, the daughter who's important for the show, and then the offstage daughter who is dying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And his Mrs. Moriarty, who is a former or current opera singer, like, that's her whole thing,
right.
Is that she's like, I used to be sing opera, and now I'm a kind of faded diva. but they're all angry at Sherlock Holmes because he was angry at Moriarty, and they're annoyed that he got away with, you know, taking Moriarty down. And so Bella has this, you know, slow dirge of a number, no disrespect, called Vendetta, where she talks about how she's going to follow in her father's footsteps, do what he did, and, you know, become the foil that Sherlock so desperately needs, and that she does as well. And Mrs. Moriarty sings in counterpoint to that, basically just agreeing with her daughter.
Sherlock Holmes will die, die a death that money can't buy.
So this is where the 93 recording gets really interesting, because in the 93 recording, Vendetta is halfway through the album. So,
okay, that to me makes way more sense, because my first thought was going to be, why on earth would you reveal this in the middle of Act 1? Like, this feels so much like it should be the end of Act 1.
And maybe it is.
So that makes way more sense.
I guess I like knowing this when we go into the next couple scenes, because there's a lot of, like, hinting around her feelings about Moriarty in the next scene that we have her in, where that would be annoying if we didn't know, but it, like, feels a little more interesting knowing. But I think other than that, it does rob some, like, potential future tension, because after that, things get a little more domestic.
Yeah, well, this is the big problem that I have with it, is that when she's Bella Spellgrove, when she shows up in the following scenes and she's just, you know, she presents herself as a client to Holmes and Watson, and then they, like, take her in. Like, they're just like, why don't you come and live with us?
Yeah, well, live with him, because Watson's married and lives elsewhere.
Yeah, but Watson's always there. But it's like, when the audience knows, I mean, because this is the Hitchcockian, like, bomb under the table situation, it's like, when you know that she's Moriarty, then on one hand, yeah, there's tension, because you don't know when that's gonna, you know, blow up in Sherlock's face. But on the other hand, Sherlock is the greatest detective in the world. Like, for him to get fooled by something, like, how does Sherlock not know that Moriarty has a daughter?
Especially,
like,
when she keeps,
you know, if that's a... Yeah, exactly. If it's a big deal, like, you know, if the big deal that you're trying to do is that, like, oh, this is the one thing Sherlock doesn't know and she's going to sneak it under his nose, then, like, that's one thing. But she keeps giving it away to, like, I guess winking at the audience, basically, that she's got ulterior motives and she's trying to, like, I assumed that when she does the, like, deep clean of his apartment, she's intentionally trying to throw him off his... you know, throw him off his game by messing with his, filing, you know, system. Safe house, basically. But there isn't, like, if that's what's happening, it's so subtle in the background that I just don't get why it's there. It could have so easily just been that she presents herself as a neutral party and that's what's fucking with him. And then, you know, oh God, she's got ulterior motives later.
This is, to me, the wrong version of how to do the plot point in Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, where, you know, we have a woman come in and kind of throw him off his game and is revealed later to be the villain. But at least in Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, we don't sense it at first. We know there's something fishy going on with her.
Right.
But we don't know, like, to full extent that she is the bad guy.
Yes.
Whereas in this, they're like, nope, bad guy. This is Moriarty.
Right. Scene 3, villain reveal. So I want to jump ahead. So let me just fill in some of the details that happened in the meanwhile.
Oh, yeah.
Sherlock gets four duchesses who arrive on the same day, and the first...
We only see the fourth one on stage.
And the first two letters of their names spell out Moriarty, and the first two letters of each of their dogs, missing dogs' names, which is why they're there, spell out Revenosia, which we interpret to be revenge. So he's like, ah, okay, Moriarty is back. Cool. And then they get invited to the Royal Gallery to see an art show by Ms. Bella Spellgrove. And when they arrive, a portrait she's done of a man who is definitely Moriarty. I mean, we saw the painting earlier. So this is a real painting that existed, even though it doesn't need to have. And she's like, oh, yeah, just a guy, a math professor guy that I saw some time ago. And Sherlock's like, it must have been Moriarty. And he must not have wanted his face revealed. But the painting has been stolen. And they decide that it's not safe for her to be out in London, which is why she has to move in with Sherlock, because Mary Watson would have a fit if someone beautiful was living in their house, apparently. There's a deduction song in this one, too, called Look Around You.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Just to mention that both of them have deduction songs.
Similarly, it's before they head to the academy, it's basically him... See, this is another thing. It's like, if this is Holmes explaining to Lestrade, like, you know, how his deduction works, but you know, he sings this whole song about how he understands everything, and, you know, it's so easy when you just look at the details, and then we immediately head into a scene of him not getting any of the details about who Bella Spellgrove actually is.
Yeah. I also like, in the Royal Gallery scene, Watson is, quote, devastated by the beauty of Bella Spellgrove, and then his function in the scene is to create a literal smokescreen by smoking outside of the nook that her painting is in so that nobody interrupts them while they're talking.
So then we cut from there to outside 221B, which is in what is very obviously, you know, another kind of scene change number between where Mrs. Hudson is talking about how odd it is that there's now a woman living with Sherlock Holmes and how she's changing things around here. We then move into the part of the song with the Irregulars, where they're singing basically just about what their function is in the story, same as they do with Leave It to Us, Gov.
Yep,
pretty much.
Although I like this song more.
It's called Anything You Want to Know.
Yeah, I think it's got a nice rhythm to it. It's in a little 6/8 time.
The price of a barrel of biscuits, all slices of veal and a pie,
a place to buy cherries,
or dry Spanish cherries.
These are examples, a few random samples of merchandise I can supply. If there is anything you want to know, if there is anywhere you want to go, there must be somewhere that you want to go. And if there should be, could be, I'm the man to know.
And then we go to Baker Street, and sure enough, Bella Spellgrove has cleaned. Yeah. She has done the womanly thing of cleaning the entire apartment.
All I can think about is the producers, because the producers has a version of this joke, but the version of the joke is that she has painted everything, including, like, paintings and the numbers on the combination lock.
Yeah.
White to clean it up. But then that leads into a song that Matthew Broderick's character sings called That Face. And this leads into a song that Watson sings called Her Face.
Her Face. That's right. This is also a situation where, similar to the producers, where, because we go back later, we have to return to the 2T1B returned to its normal state that it was in the top of the show, which means that you do need to build, like, two entire sets for this.
Oh, I bet this is a redress.
Like, you can't just...
I bet this is, like...
I don't think you can redress it. There's, like, bullet holes in the wall in the original version.
True.
It definitely feels like this wants to be the kind of show that has a lot of sets, though. It feels like it's going for this. I mean, even though it's in the West End, it feels like it wants to be an 80s mega musical.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's very heavily implied by it. Just the fact that it is so bombastic when it needs to be, and, you know, it's taking place in so many locations. Like, you know, this is the kind of show where you either build everything or you do it incredibly simplistically. Mm-hmm. But there's no way that, you know, in that OG production, it had to have been that they built everything. Yeah, it's 1989. That's British mega musical was a whole thing. Wow. Phantom was like 3 years before this.
Do we have...
I know.
Do we have photos of this one? Because I'm not sure I've seen photos of this one.
I don't think I've...
There are some photos of this one, but they're spotty. There's not an archive of them the same way there is for Baker Street. So into this clean version of Holmes's house, we have basically Bella is just kind of walking around, and Watson sings this song called Her Face, where he's basically just talking about how much he loves Bella Spellgrove's face more than his wife. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, unnoticed by Watson, Mrs. Hudson enters the room with a feather duster, and as she starts to flick things clean in his vicinity, she overhears his words and reacts to them as though they were intended for her. And then later, when Bella comes in, she's disappointed because she discovers that she's actually singing about Bella and not her. Because there is a lingering thread that gets paid off in the next scene where Mrs. Hudson is in love with both Holmes and Watson in this version, which doesn't go anywhere. It just is a thing. So,
I mean,
that's something.
In a musical, it matters who sings and who doesn't. And I think that giving a song to Mrs. Hudson is a choice.
Yeah.
I think that in most adaptations, she is not a significant enough character where you'd think that she needs a song. And I think giving her a song makes her more sympathetic. And then if you don't pay it off, then I'm not sure what it's doing.
That's the problem, is that they don't. Like, I agree that it's, you know, giving her a song is an indication from them that they're like, well, we need to build something for this character. But, like, Mrs. Hudson, after her number, does not do anything significant. Like, her arc does not pay off in any satisfying way. Again, it's the form dictating the content. You know, they're like, well, we need to have a big, you know, burlesque number or something for Mrs. Hudson. So I guess give her some more, you know, tension of unrequited love, because then we can put this number in. So I don't know if it fully pays off for me. Holmes walks in and he's, you know, angry about the fact that she cleaned up the whole apartment.
Well, he walks in disguise.
Yeah, but he's angry.
Right, he's also angry, but he walks into disguise as Sebastian Moran, and she deduces him. Mm-hmm. And then over the like next page or two, she makes a number of like deductions and a number of like Sherlock Holmes has met his match isms, where she's like, oh, well, I clean up your cigars and I moved them a little further from the fireplace so they could kept at the exact perfect temperature for cigars. And he's like, I like them dirty, actually. So the thing that I think is interesting about this is that like she's making all these deductions and he does not like get that she is like a person of interest. He's like, wow, it's crazy how I'm looking for Moriarty and this woman who is the right age to be Moriarty's daughter has just shown up at my doorstep and is like acting like a female me. That sure is weird.
Well, I mean, there's no way he could know that this is Moriarty. He doesn't know that Moriarty had a wife or children.
Right, but I feel like the whole Sherlock Holmes canon is him getting one little piece of data and being like, I've already extrapolated the solution.
That's fair.
I feel like she makes no effort to hide the fact that she's above average intelligence here. And I feel like if she's playing the long game, which she must be, she would just pretend to be any other housewife. Like, that's what I thought she was getting at when she, like, cleans everything.
Yeah. Maybe this is the problem. It's not that we know that it's Moriarty's daughter, but, like, we already know her end game. Like, we know that she's trying to take down Sherlock Holmes, so why is she being so open about it to the face of the greatest deduction person in history? Like, you know, the bit where she, right before the song, she makes him a hot toddy, and he comments on the fact that it's good, and her response is, it's how my father liked it. And I'm like, are you trying to get caught? Like, it's such a weird bit. Plus, I mean, the whole setup of this number is basically just, you know, that Sherlock Holmes is misogynistic and dumb. And
yes, there's a lot of, like, when action is happening, I think he says, the place of women is in, like, dark rooms alone, basically.
Yeah. And then so Bella is, you know, obviously trying to... I feel like a lot of this number is her trying to intentionally provoke him into some sort of emotional response, which she arguably gets in the second part of the song when he, you know, throws it right back at her.
Yeah, a couple of things I want to highlight. He calls Watson the ideal lodger, and they have this back and forth. She goes, but he's not a woman. And Holmes goes, of all Watson's many qualifications as a near-perfect companion, that is the foremost. Which I don't think they mean in a gay way, but you know, I'm here to read it that way. She goes, but is he pretty? Is he fragrant? And Holmes says, Watson, of course he is. He's as pretty as a walrus and as fragrant as a Kyber cloud, which is the cigars. But with all his faults, he's Watson. Which...
That's romantic.
Which is yeah, there's something very sweet about that.
They're in love.
The song is called Men Like You, that this goes into. And the answering lyric is... Men like you infuriate women like me, or some other descriptor word.
Anything you can do, I can do better.
Well, yeah. it's very that. It's also very. Oh God, what's that song in Wicked? Loathing. Yeah.
Loathing. Yeah. Called?
What is this
it's
feeling?
Called, what is this yes. feeling?
Yeah, it's that exact thing. This is the stage direction. They pace the room in opposite directions, outwardly seething, each of them simultaneously annoyed with and intrigued by the other, and yet enjoying the confrontation.
Women like
men like that
confused men like
women like
me, which indicates clearly that we should leave in me. And that is why you see it's tragic, but it's true that men like me like
women like me like
staying well away from
running into Spain for
women like
men like
you.
Yeah, I mean, this is interesting too, because what this song is essentially depicting is that the natural state of, you know, a woman and a man like Bella and Sherlock here is that they complement each other in the same way because they both push back the same amount. Her verse ends with her singing, that is why you see it's tragic, but it's true that women like me like battling men like you. And he similarly ends with a similar thing. Women like you like challenging men like me. The difference, of course, being is that, like, this is what's weird about it, right? Is that they set up this scene where she's, you know, matching him, like, point for point on deduction and understanding things and, you know, the idea that she's, the, you know, the female version of him. But then in the song, they just frame it as, like, you know, oh, well, the reason we're perfect rivals is because we're a man and a woman, and naturally they're going to butt heads. It's like, well, no, right. The reason that she's an ideal rival is because she's as smart as him in deducing things. You just did that. Like, you did it in your own show, and then you undercut it with the following song by being like, well, this is just a gender thing. And I'm like, well, no, it isn't. We just established that it's not. So right. It's a very weird, like, you know, I read it, again, in kind of an 80s, like, did they feel like they needed to put, like, a girl boss in Sherlock Holmes? Like, I don't know why this.
Right.
But, I don't dislike it. I think it's actually a pretty good song, and it does do the thing of, it's a good one to forward the story rather than just, you know, be a little cul-de-sac. But yeah, it doesn't quite jibe with the scene that comes before it.
Yeah. Yeah. There's an energy here, too, that is like, can a man and a woman ever be just rivals?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it certainly is like, you know, like loathing, or what is this feeling in Wicked, mm-hmm. where it's like, this is actually, you know, we can understand this on two levels, and one of those is like, about a future closeness.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I complimented Baker Street earlier for how it handled the Holmes and A romanticism, and this is the one that, like, it just kind of skirts on the edge of, you know, they're not going to consummate this relationship, but it does get pretty close to the edge on this one of, like, you really, by the end of this, you expect that these two are either going to fight or bang. Like, there's only two options here.
Well, and the scene just kind of fades to black, and I was like, really?
Yeah.
I read it a couple times. I was like, nothing happens. They don't, like, the next thing that happens is we have Mrs. Hudson's Sad on the Stoop song, which feels like a real halt to the dramatic tension.
Yeah. And it's also weird because the next interaction that Holmes and Bella have, if you want to cast interaction in the widest possible net, is that she goes missing and he's like, well, I have to go find her now. I'm like, why? You just sang a whole number about how you're, like, butting up against her, and not in the way that you were butting up against Moriarty, where you were like, oh, he's the perfect rival. Like, he has not framed her as perfect rival in this song.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only way to read it is, like, some level of interest.
Yeah.
But somehow, in between the end of this song and the middle of Miss Hudson's song, they are separated long enough for her to disguise herself in his clothes and get out of the house. Yeah. So I guess the number ends with them throwing out their hands and retreating to different corners of the apartment. I'm really not sure.
I do not know. It's kind of unclear. The logistics of basically everything that happens in the following two numbers, which includes the Where Is She song, I have a lot of questions about the logistics here.
So Mrs. Hudson sings her sad song. I just have to give a moment for the name of the henchman who is watching the outside of the apartment.
Yep. You're talking about Potatoes Clark.
Potatoes Clark.
Potatoes Clark.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I do love Potatoes Clark.
We love Potatoes Clark.
New drag name.
More love for Potatoes Clark. So Mrs. Hudson sings her sad song about being a lonely widower. It's basically a married man.
Yeah, this is the inverse of a married man. This is her being like, now my husband is gone and I have to throw my love somewhere else. Like, you know, married man is much more about him being like, I'm kind of at, you know, I'm sad, but I'm at peace. And this is her being like, I'm sad, and now I have to throw myself at the two men that I, you know, work for. It's very weird.
Yeah. But...
And the whole thing, as we have pointed out, is written in phonetic Cockney.
Yeah. Because she's lower class. Oh, Bella goes out, disguises Holmes. Watson goes out to buy chocolates for Bella. And then Holmes rushes out because he realizes that Bella is missing. And this goes into this, like, find her sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And she's like, he will find me when I let him. And I will get my revenge.
And then she does.
So the final scene in Act 1 mm-hmm. is basically her kind of enacting... Is it phase 1 of the plan? I'm not entirely... Is this phase 3? Like, what phase of the plan are we in?
A phase of the plan. I mean, you could argue that it starts with them in the gallery when Watson is smoking like a train. This is just the next step in whatever grand scheme she's cooked up. But
she wants him dead and disgraced. So this is part disgraced of the plan.
Yeah. So she basically lures him to an artist studio where she basically plays not dumb, but she's like, oh, I had to, you know, disappear in order for to make you find me. I knew you could do it because you're so cool.
Like, they just had a whole song where she was like, you're actually not that cool.
Yeah, exactly. But she's like, I actually wanted you here because I wanted to paint you and you wouldn't let me do it. And he's like, okay. Well, then weirdly, he's like, I guess all people have a price, so I might as well sit here and let you paint me, which is totally out of character for Holmes. Meanwhile, we can also hear Mrs. Moriarty singing her song off stage, so we know she's at least, like, around. But anyway, she makes him another hot toddy, which is obviously drugged in some way. So he falls asleep. They drag over... I want to be clear about this. This is not all the information that we get in the scene. This is just me stating what we later figure out to be true, because it's even more wild when you know the actual context of it. So Sherlock Holmes is drugged. Bella drags him over to the ground, and then her mom comes out with the dead body of her own daughter, who's Bella's sister, and they, like, then she's, like, gonna stab her, and then she can't do it because it's her daughter, and then Bella goes over and grabs the dagger and doesn't take it from the mom to do the dagger herself. She grabs her own hands around the dagger with the mom, and they both stab the dead corpse of their daughter. And then she puts the dagger into Holmes' hand, and the other daughter, I think it's Amelia, is that her name?
Yes.
She is dressed as Bella. Like, she's dressed in an outfit that they know Bella to be wearing. So basically, they set it up to make it look like Sherlock Holmes, you know, was lured into this artist's den by Bella and then stabbed her, and then he wakes up basically right in time for Lestrade to come in and catch him seemingly red-handed. But I do want to just really uphold the fact that the plan that Bella put together is, okay, me and my mom are going to get my dead sister, and we're going to dress her like me, and then I'm going to make my mom stab her daughter's corpse, which is also absolutely buck wild.
It's insane.
And the sister is alive at the beginning of the musical, so the whole plan hinges on the sister dying in time.
Yeah.
Which is also crazy.
Yeah, like at the opening, during Vendetta, she's off stage and, like, referred to as, you know, being sick and stuff. Maybe she didn't even contact Holmes until the sister was already dead. Like, you have to assume that that's what happened. They're just waiting for her to die of natural causes.
Well, but the body can't be too dead, because it'd be obvious that it died. I mean, like, forensics weren't that good.
The timing has to be. Also, and I can't even, how could I forget? The way that she escapes is that she doesn't leave. She looks up at the skylight, and then a hooded figure drops a ladder down, and then she climbs up the ladder out of the skylight through the roof. And that's how she escapes out of her own lair, despite the fact that there is a door that the mom came through that she could have exited through.
Wait, where does the mom go?
Through the door. The mom just leaves through the door.
Okay, incredible.
Yeah, it incredible. Says there's Mrs. Moriarty, still sobbing, leaves by the door, and then Bella puts the key in the lock and then exits through the skylight. I guess that she had to lock it from the inside, but again, it's just, whatever.
Well, yeah. The second act opens with, like, another version of Sherlock Holmes, and is like, he's been caught, he's done something bad, ooh, Sherlock, he's a bad guy now. But it turns into, like, an interrogation between Lestrade and Holmes, and Lestrade is like, yeah, the opera singer neighbor downstairs talked to us and said that she heard you
true.
Both fighting and, like, arguing, and, like, that you were her lover and that you didn't want to see her go with anybody else, and, like, stupid stuff like that. So the mom, I guess, left the room and then did the rest of their plan to make Holmes more disgraced and make the cops think that Holmes did it, but it's also Lestrade, so we know, like, Holmes is going to get out of it some way.
Yeah, like you said, top back to, we have a brief moment with the Irregulars where they sing, you know, a very upbeat song that is the opening number, except it's all about how he is a murderer now.
But
which news must have flown extremely quickly, because when we cut to Lestrade and Holmes still in the studio, so, like, I guess he must have sent the other cops out to go, like, spread the word.
Go tell the urchins of London.
Yeah, exactly.
Lestrade yells out the window, hey!
Yeah. But anyway, then Holmes and Lestrade have their little tete-a-tete scene where Holmes outwits Lestrade and then ends up, like, you know, he finds out all the information that he needs to about, like, who Bella actually is, and then he, like, somehow does his magical baritsu technique to lock Lestrade in his own handcuffs, which definitely reads like very Houdini to me and not necessarily like martial artist.
I think that Lestrade must be the character done most dirty adaptationally, because, like, Holmes in the books makes some, like, criticisms of Lestrade's intelligence, but, like, clearly as a police officer, like, I think he's a man of a normal intelligence who just happens to be in the same field as Sherlock Holmes. I think that's what's happening. But a lot of adaptations are like, he's the dumbest man walking.
This version does not have a great depiction of Lestrade. Even Baker Street at least had the decency to just make him kind of incidental to the plot. This one does feel like they're kind of out for him. But yeah, so Holmes, he basically asks Lestrade, give me 24 hours to find Bella and cure this. And Lestrade says no. So then Holmes handcuffs Lestrade and then shoves his own scarf in his mouth.
So we're getting into the part of the script that I haven't had time to read yet. So a lot of these things are going to come as surprises to me.
Yeah.
But they don't think that the corpse is Bella.
Yeah, they think the corpse is Bella.
Yeah, they think it's her.
Then why does Sherlock Holmes need time to go find Bella?
I think Holmes kind of figures it out.
Yeah, he notices that there's no blood stains. So he figures there must be some sort of rat.
Yeah.
So anyway, he gets out, and then the urchins find out about that as well. And they're like, okay, he escaped now, and he's going to try to figure this out. And so then Watson's hanging out in his thing. He's confused as to how Holmes could possibly be a murderer. Mrs. Hudson Watson, a Chelsea pensioner who could not more obviously be fucking Holmes if he had a shirt that said, I am Sherlock Holmes on it.
He's actually followed by a giant neon sign that says, this is Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, this is like the third disguise he's had. And listeners, believe me, this is not the last one he'll have. But yeah, so basically he sings about it and then he goes straight to his test tubes and stuff, which have all been reset up, I guess. Watson did that when he was gone. And then he's like, okay, we're going to figure this out. This person...
Yeah. Was also before the song, like, Holmes, you were in love. This was a crime of passion. You had feelings for the girl.
Mm-hmm.
Like, kind of, like, all jealous. Like, very much in vain of the BBC Sherlock, where Watson is kind of the jealous, petty girlfriend. Being like, you like her, and I like her, but I also wish you liked me.
Yeah. And then Holmes sings a song called No Reason, which is basically his version of Cold Clear World, where he sings, like... You know, basically, it's illogical to be in love, so I can't do it because I'm the logic man. I just want to uphold this line from Watson at the very end of the song, where he says, you're right, Holmes, women are not reasonable. No one knows better than I. My own wife, Mary, I think her name is, just threw me out of the house for no better reason than because I was or am your friend. You said that Lestrade might be done dirtiest by these adaptations, but Watson really gets knocked to the side in this one.
Also, like, I get that she threw him out because Holmes is a murderer, I suppose. But also, like, the queer subtext meter is beeping for me as well. Like, my wife threw me out of the house for being with you, for, like, supporting you. Feels
very... Yeah, that's one option. I would also maybe posit the suggestion that he doesn't know his wife's name.
Well, my God. I want to point out what he says before the song, too, about how he felt about being with Bella. He says, though I will admit I did experience considerable pleasure in her company, enhanced by a temporary loss of reason. It just doesn't feel like Sherlock Holmes to me.
Yeah. No, like I said, this production, it manages to, like, keep its plausible deniability that he's in love, but, like, so clearly this musical wants to just be like, he's in love with Bella and it's clouding his judgment and that's the Sherlock Holmes thing. But they can't say that because otherwise they'll, you know, ruin the character. He can't... It's why he sings No Reason. It's just him... You know, the obvious read of this song is that he's deluding himself into believing he's not in love because, you know, he has to be Sherlock Holmes. That's his whole thing.
Yeah, whereas, like, Cold Clear Reason in the other musical is, like, a thesis statement of, like, someone who's settled on something. And then Irene's counterstatement is, maybe rethink it?
Yeah. What Baker Street does really well is that it manages to find a reason why Sherlock Holmes would be intrigued by the concept of love, but also wouldn't feel it. Like, he, you know, he understands what love is, you know, on a logistical level, but he just doesn't feel it himself. And so he kind of just is like, well, it's just not for me. Like, it's just, you know, which is a great aromantic representation where he's just kind of like, I get that it exists. I'm not an idiot. It's just not something that I'm in any way intrigued by or, like, you know, open to experiencing myself. Meanwhile, in this one, he's like a romance tsundere where he's like, I'm definitely not in love right now. That's definitely not me. It's just such a cheap way of dealing with the character. Like, you know, when there's so many other better options out there. Like,
a lot of adaptations, not just the musicals, but especially these two musicals, think that the most interesting question you can ask about Sherlock Holmes is women, huh?
Yeah.
And I think there are probably more interesting stories to tell about Sherlock Holmes that don't have to deal with this question. Like, I mean, BBC Sherlock, like, circles this question for so long that you realize that they don't have an answer, you know?
Yeah.
Like, Baker Street at least has an answer in mind when they ask the question. I guess we'll find out if this one does also.
Yeah. I mean, it does have an answer at the end, kind of. We'll see.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's like, I don't want to throw musical theater under the bus as a medium, but this is also a similar thing that, like, this is my go-to example for this is when they did the Addams Family musical. And they were like, well, what should the conflict for the Addams Family musical be? And they were like, well, we don't have a single character that's not in a relationship already or of an age where it makes sense to put them in a relationship. So instead of not doing a love plot, they aged a character up so that they could do, like, a teen romance angle with the Addams Family of all fucking things. Like, like, what? Like, they were so committed to this idea that the musical had to center on love for some reason that they were like, I don't know, age Wednesday up and make her, you know, the ingenue of this show.
We can't think of plots that we have to do La Cage aux Folles, but with spooky.
Right, and the only romances that should exist in the Addams Family is Gomez and Morticia being absolutely ham for each other, and in the sequel in the movie, having everyone be randomly horny for Uncle Fester for no reason. Because that's funny! It's funny
that's
to do that!
That's so good!
But for some reason, the Addams Family musical was just like, what is the most stock musical theater plot we can give it? And even if we have to bend the characters to the shape of this plot, we need to have a romance in this show. And I'm like, no, you don't. Like, have it be like Gomez gets arrested or something and no one can understand why because they don't understand what they're doing is wrong. Like, there's so many different ways you could deal with it. But for some reason, when you're writing a musical on stock tropes, which, you know, credit to the Addams Family, it's not all stock tropes. Like, you know, it just feels like that's the obvious thing. You're like, well, clearly we need to have a romantic lead. I mean, even something like Mary Poppins. Like, Walt Disney was gunning so hard to have a Mary and Bert relationship, and it only didn't end up in the movie because P.L. Travers absolutely put her foot down that it couldn't. But, like, you can see that movie struggling with, you know, being like, we've clearly set up a romantic pair here, and, you know, we've basically built all the, like, setup of a romance, but we can't actually pay it off. And,
right,
you know, this feels like it's in a similar place of being like, well, we really want Holmes to admit that he's in love with Bella Moriarty, but we can't because, you know, it would destroy the entire character.
Yeah, well, and you're right that, like, especially in the 80s, there are very few major musicals that aren't love stories.
Mm-hmm.
Or don't have a love story as a major element.
Yeah. Shout out to Cats.
Yes!
The only musical that is good from the... That's not true.
No, you're correct. You're correct. So at this point, Holmes is like, hey, go check out the body. Luckily, Lestrade walks in and is like, where's Holmes? And Watson's like, he ain't here. But hey, where's that body? And Lestrade spills the beans and that it's somehow Watson's old friend, Boffy Martindale.
What?
Yeah.
Wait,
that
oh,
has
yeah.
the body.
Yeah, so Boffy Martindale, who runs the morgue at Scotland Yard, question mark? He's in charge, and so Watson walks in, and he's like, ah, my old friend Boffy, I remember. And then they immediately start reminiscing about their old times when they were, like, both medical students together hitting on nurses. And then they sing a song called Halcyon Days, which is, I'm not even joking here, this is a, like, British, like, rousing pub anthem that they are both singing together to themselves in a morgue.
In a morgue.
Those were Halcyon Days, blessing the praise of our Halcyon Days. Here's to Halcyon Days. Oh, to go back again
and take another crack again.
Oh, yes. At those heavenly Halcyon Days.
Cheers!
Cheers, Buffy!
And another one!
Oh, no, no more, Buffy, truly.
They sing this whole song just about how cool it was when they were kids. And then, basically, at the end, Watson's like, oh, yeah, right, I forgot that I'm here to see a body. Let me go see the body. And he takes one look at the body and is like, well, that's clearly not Bella, and then walks out. Like, just immediately. This could have been a phone call.
This could have been an email.
Yeah.
I love that this is a thing that, I mean, we'll talk more about how these two musicals work in comparison to each other, but both of them have this musical theater thing where it's like, sometimes it's the middle of the second act and you just need to give the crowd something.
Yeah.
Here's a number.
Yeah, a little bit. And then immediately following this, we have a kind of low-tempo version of Without Him, There Can Be No Me, but it's sung by Bella, where she's talking about how well she, like, pairs off with Sherlock Holmes, which is very clearly her, you know, being in love with him and not willing to admit it herself. Mm-hmm. Because she's basically having the same thing where she's like, oh, but he pairs me so well, maybe I can't kill him. Anyway, so then the mom comes out and explains that Sherlock Holmes has, you know, escaped and is not dead. And so then
This is the part where I kind of went, what are we doing? What's going on?
Yeah, this next number is where the musical takes a turn towards the actually completely inept. So,
I read this part like 5 times to make sure I was getting what was happening. And I still, for the life of me, cannot decipher what is happening.
This is the scene. The Apples and Pears pub. This is where I established the theory that Leslie Bricus just wanted to write a musical and Sherlock Holmes was available with no copyright. Like, I think he just wanted to write this song. So basically they enter. So Bella is like, okay, I know exactly where to hide, where Sherlock Holmes probably went to when he needed to, like, escape from being found. And so they go to the Isle of Dogs, which is where the Apples and Pears pub is. And what's important here to understand is that Bella is in disguise as somebody. Like, she's just in disguise as random person in the thing, mm-hmm. in the bar. And then as she's just, like, talking with these, they're literally called, like, first down and out, second down and out, third down and out, like, random ensemble characters about what their crimes are and, like, what, you know, all the criming they've been doing in the crime city. It says, during this exchange, a grubby, unshaven costermonger has entered, pushing a fruit barrow. And I immediately, while reading, was like, so that's Holmes. That's definitely Holmes. That's just absolutely Holmes. And so
it's
then he comes right. in and less than a page. He's talking in, like, Cockney rhyming slang. And mm-hmm. Bella, I guess, doesn't know what that is for some reason. And I truly cannot tell if she's feigning indifference of knowing what it is or if she's, like, actually unclear on what's going on.
Well, this is the question, is does the musical ever explain what she's been doing for her whole childhood?
No.
Like, has she been a high society girl, or is she familiar with the criminal underclass, or somehow it was both?
No, she does not explain. No explanation given. So she is confused by, or at least feigns confusion of, his Cockney rhyming slang. And then he's like, well, I might as well sing a whole song about that. And so then Sherlock Holmes in disguise, I want to be very clear about this. Sherlock Holmes, played by Ron Moody, in disguise as random costermonger, sings a song called Down the Apples and Pears, which is basically just him making a bunch of jokes about Cockney rhyming slang, in which the ensemble sings the translation into regular English.
His plates of meat.
Round his feet, all night.
Oh, the mince pies, saw his dainty roots.
Saw his boots and his hat.
And his tip and tat in his promised land.
In his hand and for all land.
The old boy and lord.
Gnashed his teeth.
Nest his hands dirty.
Took a sailor.
A tinker tailor down the lane and looked.
Down the church.
Then all because he took him unawares and he fell down the apples and pears.
It goes on for, like, 3 pages. And it does nothing for the narrative, and almost immediately, as soon as it's done, he whips the costume off and he sums. So Sherlock Holmes just sang this big song.
Wow.
Like, in universe, Sherlock Holmes is singing this. This is a diegetic number. So basically, the Wiggins is there, and the other irregulars are there, and so he, you know, basically feeds them the information that he needs them to know about how he's actually alive, and that there's a plan to, you know, undercut her. But then a rumor starts spreading around. I don't know if he spreads it or if it just...
Yeah, he kind of spreads it or tells it to Wiggins. And then Wiggins kind of catches on, like, oh, okay, this is part of a plan.
Yeah. But basically, like, I think Sherlock at this point is still convinced that Moriarty might still be alive. Like, there's some question up to this point about whether or not Moriarty survived the fall in the same way that Sherlock did. So he starts spreading the rumor that Moriarty's actually alive secretly, which Bella, of course, gets wind of and is like, oh, no, my dad. She doesn't say that, but, you know. And so then, you know, she kind of wanders out. And I do mean wanders. It literally says, like, Bella vanishes from view, and then Holmes and Watson just kind of come out, and he's in his normal outfit now. But, yeah, so then Holmes figures out, finally, that Bella is Moriarty. And he says it to Watson in the most confusing way possible, where he basically is like, Moriarty's dead, but he's alive. And Watson's like, wait, but so is he dead? And he's like, yes, he's dead, but he's alive. But is he alive? No, he's dead, but he's alive. Yes. Anyway, so then he's... Yeah, and then he sings a song called My Incomparable Best, which is basically just him being like, I'm going to beat Moriarty again somehow, except it's your daughter, but it's Moriarty through a proxy, I suppose. And so he just, yeah, he sings that, it's all that. And then we go to a deserted warehouse. Bella is lured into this deserted warehouse by various ne'er-do-wells. And then we hear a door opening, and then who should come out of the shadows in the back but a shadowy figure in a wheelchair, and it's Professor Moriarty.
I'm standing up and clapping.
Oh, get ready to keep standing up. Find more things to stand on. Professor Moriarty wheels out in a wheelchair, and he's like, my child, I fall from the bridge, did some little damage, but I must be careful. And so then he sings this whole song. It's called A Million Years Ago, or Was It Yesterday, where he talks about how much she's changed in the time since, you know, she was a child, and how, you know, she is sad to have let him go and all these things.
Has he been hanging out in a warehouse for like a couple years, or how long is it? I guess it hasn't been that long.
Yeah, it hasn't been that long.
Yeah, but he's like, you've done well. And then she gets angry about that because she's like, oh, how could you only tell me now that you're alive? Like, you know, yeah, your daughter is dead and I've been fighting Sherlock Holmes. And then she says, he's just like you, but too clever for you. He's always too clever. And then Moriarty's like, oh, you seem particularly concerned for this man, Holmes. And then she's, you know, basically says like, no, I'm definitely not in love with him. And then get ready for this. So she says, Mama told me how she felt when she first met you. It was like seeing the top of the Alps, cold, remote, and beautiful, unattainable and irresistible, so far away, yet so close. And then Moriarty says, closer than you imagine, Miss Moriarty, and he takes his costume off, and it's f***ing Holmes.
Yes.
Oh my god,
I lost my mind when I read that. Are you kidding me right now? Okay,
you really can't cast the actor who plays Sherlock Holmes to have any kind of distinctive voice.
Yeah, like, no, you can't. Like, I don't know, for example, the voice of famous film actor Ron Moody.
Oh, my God.
So anyway, basically, he's like, no, your dad is actually dead, despite the fact that I just emotionally, you know, violated this moment, like, right. You know, destroyed you.
Yeah.
But then, you know, he basically compliments her on the fact that, like, okay, you are exactly like your dad. Like, you are a perfect foil for me. And then Bella says, like, hey... Rather, instead of being a perfect foil, what if we joined forces through kissing? She doesn't phrase it that directly, but she basically implies that, you know, we would be a really good pair. But then she throws a smoke bomb and...
disappears.
No, she doesn't throw a smoke bomb. No, that's what it is. They're in a warehouse that has, like, explosives in it. And so she offers to light his pipe, and then she drops the match into the thing and everything explodes and she vanishes.
Explosives where nobody really gets hurt.
Yeah, it's just a lot of smoke. Yeah. Also, Watson's here somehow.
Yeah, Watson's here. Yeah.
Okay, then we cut immediately to 221B. Holmes and Bella sing this duet where they're not together, they're just in different parts of the stage, where they're talking about, like, oh, maybe we would be really good together, but then, you know, Holmes dodges out of it the last minute to be like, no, actually, I'm still chased, I guess. But she leaves him a little bouquet of flowers, which he immediately identifies as...
some deadly nightshade.
Yes.
Belladonna
Verdinosa, which, yeah, literally is deadly nightshade, but it also literally translates to poisonous beautiful lady. And so it's like, oh, what does he mean there? And then at the very end, he basically stares out the window and says, then, sir or madam, I am ready for you. Sherlock Holmes is ready. And then there's a dramatic crescendo, and then they do a reprise of the intro song, and then we're out.
Sir
and
or madam?
Sir 88. Or madam.
Yeah. That's...
bye.
Wait, who's sir or madam?
I think he's just talking about, I don't know, a foil, right? I don't know.
Is this like, this is the end of Company? Where
yeah.
He's like, I'm ready for something, maybe.
Yeah. I'm open. I'm listing my status on Tinder as down for whatever. So that okay. is our longer than the actual show recap of the 1989 Sherlock Holmes musical.
And here I thought we weren't going to talk too much about this one.
No, so, I mean, there's so much to talk about in this one, though. Like, that's the problem. There's so much to dig into.
It's baffling.
The choices made are all over the place.
I guess let's hit a couple things real quick. I appreciate that they don't actually end up together.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because especially like when you get to Moriarty, you're dealing with like black and white good and evil, which is not always the case in Sherlock Holmes stories, but the way they get adapted, it's like evil criminal mastermind and, you know, pure-hearted hero. And like there is a more complex, more interesting conversation about like what Bella wants and why she wants it and whether like she can pursue quote-unquote good and what it would mean for like his pure-heartedness to be with somebody who like those are all potential interesting conversations that we, I guess, don't have ever have to deal with.
Well, that, like, in order to deal with those conversations, we would have to accept the base-level plot thread that Sherlock Holmes is capable of love or, like, emotional connection with someone that isn't Watson. Like, you know, fundamentally, it's an interesting question, but it relies on this, you know, betrayal of the character in order to do it.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's weird that they went as far as they did and then didn't take the final step. Like, why not let him kiss a pretty girl in the final reel? Especially because in this one, the estate wasn't breathing down their neck.
Yeah, so you'd think that this would be the one where they'd... I mean, they do take big risks in this one, but, like, it really feels like, you know... Maybe the estate wasn't breathing down their neck, but one thing that is definitely a case for Holmes adaptations even to this day, even under this, you know, current state of them being public domain, is, like, there is a huge fandom for Sherlock Holmes, and they are a vocal and defensive fandom. So... I think there's a certain level of, like, even if the estate won't stop you, there is going to be outcry if you, you know, stray too far from the source material. So I wonder how much of it was them being like, well, we'll get away with what we can get away with, but there are some, you know, some bridges we actually can't cross unless we're going to get run out of town on a rail. Like, you know, I don't know. There is almost no writing on the, like, process behind this one, as opposed to Baker Street, where there's interviews and there's some, you know, articles about it. There's very little about this.
I gotta say, Time Machine in my hand, I think I'd rather see this one. Not because I think it's the better piece, because obviously it's well, who's to say?
I mean, but I do have way more questions about how this one was done. Like, I have way more questions about the production, yeah.
Well, and, like, I think something that we learn over and over again on this podcast is, like, you learn so much more from work that misses the mark than you do from work that gets it. And I don't think either of these pieces really get it, but, like, this one... is, like, baffling. And you sort of... I just wondered, did it really hold together as a dramatic, like, evening of theater?
Yeah. I mean, I was constantly, during Baker Street conversation, bringing up this one as a counterpoint, because my hot take, and, you know, heading towards some sort of conclusion, is that, like, I don't think either of these musicals are particularly great. And this one, even more so than Baker Street, I don't even know if you need to salvage pieces from it, but, like, they're bad for such completely different reasons. Like, they're... The things that make them not work are, like, 100% different. With this one, it does have to do with, like, you know, it is too episodic, and it is that, like, you know, scenes don't flow into each other. Like, Baker Street, for all its flaws, is, you know, kind of assisted by the fact that it's adapting one story for the most part. It does have a flow. It just feels like it keeps interrupting that flow. This one, it just feels like it's, like, it feels like a collection of scenes and songs being kind of strung together by the appearance of a plot, but, you know, there's no momentum in it. It's just stuff happening over and over.
It does feel more like an event, though, on the page. It feels like a bigger show in a lot of ways, even though I think that the Baker Street is trying to be big. It feels like it's the 80s and we can do bigger stuff. You know, it's not just a winch that Wiggins is in. It's like much larger set pieces. Skylight Ladder.
I think what it is that, like, Baker Street is trying to be a big story. This is trying to take a small story and do it big. Like, this is just trying to do big things on stage, regardless of whether or not they actually assist the narrative. Like, you know, we don't need to have a big dance number here in Act Two, but, I don't know, the audience is bored, so here's Sherlock doing a, you know, Cockney drinking song. Like, here's Watson doing a different drinking song in a morgue. Like, you know, we don't need it to be there, but... you know, the audience is kind of bored and we want to do something big. As opposed to, you know, Baker Street, I think it has moments where it's, you know, a big musical, but it, you know, with the exception of Roof Space, I think it earns its big moments because the rest of it's relatively soberly proportioned. This is just all big all the time.
Well, and I think one of the questions that we're often asking is, since most of the Sherlock Holmes stories are short stories, can you do a musical-length, movie-length adaptation of Sherlock Holmes that is Moyle? Because most of the time Sherlock Holmes didn't deal with really, really big stakes and really, really big stories that took 2.5 hours to tell, with the exception of, I think, exclusively Hound of the Baskervilles.
Yeah. I think, like, if we're talking about, like, should these be a musical? Should Sherlock be a musical? Mm-hmm. Can Sherlock sing? Baker Street, I'm fine with it being a musical. I think it is light, entertaining, does what, like, that period of musical theater does. Whereas with Sherlock Holmes, the musical, I'm like, I'd prefer this as just a play.
Well,
this doesn't need to sing.
And maybe to Zach's point, it's not so much should this be a musical, it's should this be a Sherlock.
Yeah.
If you could make this about a different Victorian detective.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, right? Is that, like, imagine this thought experiment. Both of these musicals and rename all the characters to something that isn't Sherlock Holmes. Like, Baker Street would still read as a Sherlock Holmes musical. Like, you'd watch it and you'd be like, okay, so this is a ripoff of Sherlock Holmes with the serial numbers filed off. Like, the pieces and the beats and the, you know, what we expect to see in a Sherlock musical is all there. But if you take Sherlock Holmes the musical and you remove the names from it, you'd be like, okay, well, this is clearly taking some cues from Sherlock Holmes, but, mm-hmm. like, the pieces of it don't have anything to do with the character as we understand it. Like, this is clearly a different character that isn't just Sherlock Holmes, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's sort of a consequence of the fact that, you know, Sherlock Holmes, the musical, to its credit, I would say, is actually attempting to do something that is more difficult than Baker Street, which is writing an entirely original story, you know, kind of with inspiration from the Sherlock stories, but without adapting any of them directly, except for a little bit of The Final Problem. And, you know, it's a harder thing to do. I think its ambitions are higher than Baker Street, which is essentially just, you know, take A Scandal in Bohemia and, you know, add some songs to it. But, you know, with higher ambitions, it's harder to reach them. And I think that Sherlock Holmes, the Brickus musical, is aiming higher than Baker Street, but Baker Street gets closer to achieving what it sets out to do. Neither of them actually achieve it, but Baker Street's way closer. And I do think that, like, to slightly adjust what I said earlier, if I had a time machine and I could go back in time and watch one of these two musicals, I would much rather watch the 1989 one just because it's so buck wild and weird.
Yeah.
And I want to know how they did everything. But if I had to pick one of these two that I'd want to watch a contemporary production of, 100% it's Baker Street. Because I think that it would translate better. Again, we're talking about scripts and scores here. We haven't seen productions of these. Baker Street has more potential to be good in performance than Sherlock Holmes does. There's more in it that I believe you can get good stuff out of. Like, I think that the potential for a good version of Baker Street is much higher than a good version of Sherlock Holmes the musical. And I say that having earlier, you know, said that I don't think that Baker Street is worth salvaging. I just think that there's more that you could get out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I think it's telling that with the Brickus 89 Sherlock Holmes, the only major production of it that achieved success was when it had been revised and given a framing device of a music hall performance, because mm-hmm. then the, like, more soap opera elements of it have this sort of natural thing that they exist in, a framework that allows us to not be surprised by big crazy choices and emotions. I mean, it is such a soap opera plot. It's such a telenovela. Mm-hmm. Like, you killed my father and I have sworn revenge on you and I'm going to use the corpse of my sister to frame you for murder. And, like, it's insane. Or, like, I'm going to disguise myself as your dead father to emotionally manipulate you.
I'm still so turnt over that. It's just such a weird pull. Well, yeah, also, no, I agree.
I feel like the musical also, just to, like, jump back to an earlier point, can't decide how smart Bella is, because, like, at the beginning, mm-hmm. in the first act, she's, like, outsmarting Sherlock, and she, like, notices when he's disguised, and then he does, like, a disguise that she should know is obvious, mm-hmm. because she knows her father is dead, and she doesn't catch it. And there's a couple things like that, I think, in the second act, where it's, like, either she's the smartest woman alive and a perfect match for him, or she's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A benefit of Baker Street is the fact that Moriarty's barely in it. Like, we know that he's Sherlock's foil because Sherlock says that he is, but it keeps him mostly off stage except for his number and, like, a couple of other moments. But Sherlock Holmes, the musical, has given itself the burden of proof. It has given itself I'm stealing this line directly from Dan Olsen because it's a great line, the trap card of falsifiability. Once you commit to putting, you know, the foil to Sherlock Holmes on stage, then the burden of proof is on you to make her the perfect foil to Sherlock Holmes. Like, you have to prove that suddenly, as opposed to just having him be like, well, it's Moriarty, and obviously he's, you know, great.
Right. Well, like, I feel like we talk about it a lot, but it speaks to, I think, what Moriarty was written to be in the books. Like, the point of Moriarty was always that he's off page, and trust me, he's the worst, and he's the only equal to Sherlock Holmes, and you don't even need to see him to get that.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually think it's an issue with Baker Street that we don't meet Moriarty until the end of the... I mean, I think this is why the first act ends where it does, because the second act would be too late to introduce him. But I think one of my problems with Baker Street as a piece is that we spend so long not meeting Moriarty that when you do, you're sort of like, oh, okay, I guess this guy's the main villain now.
That and that they don't show any of the, like, actual... evil that he's doing, like the jewel heist happens off stage, and the, you know, his escape in a balloon happens off stage. He's not even in the ending. He literally has a like recording of himself just taunting Sherlock. Like, at the very least, Ratigan showed himself putting the record on, like,
right,
you know.
Also, I think both of these oddly end in a very similar place despite going on very different journeys, which mm-hmm. is this, like, Sherlock has decided to open himself to something, and there may be a future for him and a woman, right? Mm-hmm. In both cases. And I think it's really interesting that neither of these pieces really deal with the Holmes-Watson dynamic. Yeah. Like, the ending of most Sherlock Holmes stories is like, we said huzzah, and we high-fived, and we went to the opera, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's interesting that in both cases he gets shaken up and... like, moves forward into a new direction instead of going back to the stasis, which is often how the Sherlock Holmes stories work, because they're serial mm-hmm. stories. And interesting that Watson doesn't play a major role in either pieces. We should jump into the rating system.
Yes.
Yes, explain to me your mystical rating system.
I will.
We have a glorious rating system.
It's we rate all of the pieces we deal with on a 5-point scale, which is loyalty to source material, grade of mystery, Britishness, total enjoyment, and queer subtext, or LGBTQ.
You know, it's funny, because throughout this conversation, we've continued to, you know, hint at the queer subtext of these stories, but I feel like, while I wouldn't say that it isn't there, obviously, like, we're going to get to that point when we get to it, mm-hmm. these are two of the straightest adaptations of Sherlock Holmes yep. that exist. Like, these yep. do not have queer subtext in them. I mean, they do, but, like, they are not mining it for any discernible degree. Both of them feel very much the need to, like, the only pair for Sherlock, it's gotta be a woman. Which is so weird.
Who'd have thunk that the musical theater one would be the straightest?
Exactly. Like,
but I think it's something that's baffling about the entire genre, is that the entire genre of musical theater is beloved by queer people, employs so many queer people, and also, for most of its life, has turned out extraordinarily straight work. With some occasional bursts of textual queerness and a couple more bursts of subtextual queerness.
Yeah, and odd how it takes a story like this that already has so much queer subtext in it and, you know, chooses not to make that the thing. You know, I know the 60s were a different time and the 80s were a different time, but, like, this is the easiest story to, you know, put the queer subtext in or make it really overt and then turn to the audience and be like, well, that's not us. That's just in the source material. We're,
right.
You know, you have such an out. But anyway, sorry. Well, I'll go through your point scale.
Yeah, so for each one, we're going to all three talk about it and agree on a number out of 5
cool.
for each point, and we'll do one score for Baker Street and then another score for Sherlock Holmes.
So let's start with the first one, Baker Street, and mm-hmm. let's start with loyalty to source material. How loyal is this show?
I think 4? It's going to score, I think 4. I think it scores fairly high for me. I think it loses some points for all of Moriarty. And obviously the Diamond Jubilee stakes are higher. I don't really understand Moriarty's goal. I think it feels like a little too showy for Moriarty, but I'd say that 3 or 4 for me.
I'm leaning 4 just on the grounds of, I do think that, again, what they do with the romance angle with Iris, it is like discussed in a way that makes sense for Sherlock to be there, and they don't consummate it. I think that that's a lot of restraint on their part, but that still manages to make a great plot out of it. If it loses a point, it's for the sidelining of Watson, and like you said, the fact that Moriarty is not really a presence in it. He's more of a looming force. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. I'm also willing to go with 4.
Cool. Go with that.
Alrighty.
So now let's talk about...
loyalty to source material.
For Holmes 89.
Yes.
It's low.
Two.
Two
seems high.
Two makes sense to me because my debate was, I'm like, is it good enough to go up to a 3? And I'm like, it's definitely not. But I don't think it's too low to go to a 1. Like, it still has... They didn't introduce an... Okay, they did actually introduce new characters.
1.5.
What about Potato Jack or whatever?
No, Potatoes Clark. I think Potatoes Clark is from the books, right? I think that's I mean, it's one of the irregulars. I would assume they didn't make up those names.
I think they did.
Wait, we need to take a Google
Potatoes Clark. If he's from the books, we're giving it 2.
I've gotten au gratin potatoes.
I'm getting recipes, yeah.
Okay,
fine, 1.5. 1.5.
I mean, I think the thing you said before is so true. I think that if you changed all the names, you'd be like, oh, Victorian Detective is kind of Sherlocky, but it's clear this is a different story because we're dealing with this, like, revenge of the daughter thing that Sherlock Holmes never deals with.
Yeah.
The romance is so out there. Like,
yeah. I mean, yeah, 1.5 feels right for me.
1.5.
Yeah. Are we allowed to do 0.5s? I know it's a 5-point
scale.
Oh, yeah.
We are.
We've gone above 5 and we've gone below 5. And we've
then 1.5. That's where it lands.
Yeah.
Alrighty. Let's talk the grade of the mystery. How good is this mystery? Baker Street? How good is she? Is it mysterious?
So, I think where the Baker Street mystery loses points for me is that we switch clients halfway through the first act, and that we're not really... Like, what is the mystery, you know, in the second act?
Yeah, in some regard, I don't understand how point A gets to point B, or what Irene really has anything to do with, or what the letters really have anything to do with anything. Yes. I know it's, like, because of this guard guy, but, like...
Right, he has to be blackmailed so they can get access to the...
But I'm also sure if you pointed, like, a bunch of guns at this guard guy, he'd probably do the same thing.
Mm. Yeah. I'm leaning, like, 2.5, just because, like, I think that it has the pieces of a good mystery, but by the end of it, like ultimately, Baker Street, while it has the mystery elements to it, I don't think that's, like, we're not watching it thinking this is a mystery. Like, I'm not watching it going, like, oh, how are they going to reveal how this all connects together? Like, you know, it feels very much like, you know, this is like we're moving from scene to scene and we're following the, like, we're following clues, but, like, it's not really a
story.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's an adventure more than it's a mystery.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, in the first act, we get mystery one. Which isn't a mystery. Someone has letters and I want them back.
Yeah.
Mystery two, my letters have been stolen. Mm-hmm. And then we never recover the letters, you know? I mean, it's a drop thread. I think a 2 seems high. I think that there isn't really a mystery. Yeah. Pretty early on, we're like, oh, it's Moriarty, and then we're just trying to bring him to justice, right?
That's true. Yeah. I mean, I would say it gets to a 2 just because it does have the bait and switch of, like, it has the bit where they're like, Moriarty is going to try to steal the jewels, and then we think that he died, but then he did actually steal the jewels. And there's, like, a lot of, like, you know... I mean, it has that, like, James Bond element, right? Where it's, like, there's that kind of, you know... Moran is sneaking in the shadows, and Sherlock is doing some actual disguises that aren't jokes, you know? I think 2 makes sense, because, again, it has the pieces there. Like, I mean, I'm... To be clear, we're going to go lower for 89. I think 2 is the right place.
Okay, if you both feel 2, I'll meet you at 2.
Yeah.
All right. 89, baby.
Solid 1. Like, I won't go to 0.5. I think it's a 1.
We've done 0 before. 0 is on the table. In 1989, the mystery is Bella invites him to the art gallery. She's like, this painting has been stolen. And then...
We completely drop that.
It never develops.
Then Sherlock Holmes gets framed for murder, which then never comes up again the moment he walks out of that art gallery or art loft.
Yeah.
Lestrade just kind of lets him go.
It's a 0 for me. There's no mystery here.
I was going to ask, is a revenge plot a mystery?
And also, in the 89 script, we find out that it's a revenge plot at the very beginning. There's no mystery to that either. We know why Bella's being weird. I think it's a 0.
Yeah.
I mean, Zach, you wanted to go 1. What would you give it a 1 for?
I was just thinking, for Holmes, it's a mystery. Like, he's still trying to figure stuff out. But for the audience, it's not. Yeah, I would go with a... You know, if you're both on a 0, I'm going to go with a 0 as well. It just doesn't, you know, even less so than the other one, I would make it a mystery. Yeah.
The mystery is his heart.
Oh,
yeah,
right.
Jesus.
Next up, we have Britishness. How British are these adaptations?
Are we talking? Okay, hold on. Can we talk? Are we talking about British parentheses derogatory, or are we talking about British parentheses complimentary? Like,
it is whatever you want it to be.
Because if we're going British derogatory, I think that the 89 gets a 5. Like, that's the problem. Like,
that's true.
Hi.
We never specified that it has to be a positive depiction of the British people.
Yeah. Okay. Give me your criteria for Britishness. Like, what other things have bumped things up in the British count?
Yes. Okay. What's gotten a 5 in Britishness?
Well, we gave a 6 in Britishness to Sherlock Holmes and the Voice of Terror, for like the whole rah rah rah. We are London.
We're strong.
We're strong.
Right.
We gave a 5 to Granada because it's Granada.
Mm-hmm.
Same with Great Mouse Detective and Private Lives of Sherlock Holmes. So we've given a good number of 5s.
Okay. On that grounds, I'm just gonna write out the gate. I think Baker Street gets a 4.5. I think that the other one gets a... also a 4.5, but for totally different reasons. I just like... Or maybe a 4. Like, there's the thing. I think that the addition of the, like, Diamond Jubilee plot...
Yes.
...to me holds a lot of weight for Baker Street and its Britishness.
Mm-hmm.
Along with its restraint in the music, I think that that's also very British. Like, it isn't... You know, the structure of it, the medium, despite the fact that it's written by Americans, I think that it, you know, reads that way. I don't know whether to go up or down from 4.5. Here's the thing. Whatever we rank Baker Street, I don't know where to put the other one, because on one hand, it's almost a parody of Britishness. But on the other hand, the style of music is like way more broad. Well, that's also very British.
I think Sherlock Holmes 89 might be a 5 for me for Britishness, because I think
I think I'm agreeing with that.
Like, London is London, and then, like, the fact that it was able to be adapted pretty seamlessly into a music hall setting in later versions, and...
Yeah, I think that makes sense to me.
Whereas, like, in Baker Street, we don't really get a big number about London, because they cut London Again, whatever that song is. And then, like, Moriarty on a yacht doesn't feel very British. Like, there's no yachts in the original Conan Doyle canon, and, like... We get 2 back-to-back numbers with Irene that have Western elements in them.
That's true. But, again, Westernness through the lens of Britishness. I think that, for me, again, the Diamond Jubilee holds a lot of weight. I think that the presence of the Irregulars feels much more pronounced in Baker Street because they don't have the larger... There's no, like, large ensemble numbers with the whole British populace.
Yeah.
But... To their credit, I think that the Irregulars are way more, like, British, yes, Cockney-coded in Baker Street than they are in... Like, it stands out more because they don't have the whole of London comparing them.
There's also a politeness to Baker Street that I feel is, like, inherently British. To me, it's very much like Baker Street is, like, the rich people in My Fair Lady, and then 1989 Sherlock Holmes is Get Me Through the Church on Time.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go 4.5, yeah. Baker Street, 5, Holmes 89.
That works perfectly for me.
Alrighty. Total enjoyment. How much did we like these shows? Let's start with Baker Street.
Are we going... Okay, let's do Baker Street first. Baker Street 3? Like, I liked a lot of Baker Street. Like, you know...
Yeah, I had a great...
There was nothing I hated about Baker Street. There was just things that were kind of disappointing about it, where it just didn't, you know, make it for me.
I would agree that it felt pretty middle of the road for me.
Yeah.
In the, like, totality of musical theater, it just feels kind of, like, forgettable. And I think it has mostly been forgotten. A 3 feels right to me. What else have you given a 3 to? For total enjoyment?
The only thing I'm thinking of is potentially dropping it to a 2.5 just because... of my point where I'm like, I don't think that it needs to be fixed. I think it just needs to be stripped for parts.
Yeah.
Like,
if we dropped it to the 2.5, it would be on par with BBC Sherlock.
Wow.
That...
Which honestly feels low for BBC Sherlock, because I often enjoy watching it. I just have a lot of feelings about it.
Yeah. That doesn't feel wrong, though. Like, I don't know.
I'm willing to go for a 3 for Baker Street.
Holmes 3 89. Works.
Okay, are we talking ironic enjoyment?
I think...
So bad.
Right, I think we have to.
I got so passionate about it. Like, I was yelling at the end there.
Is it 4?
I wouldn't go that high. If we're giving Baker Street a 3, I think we can't go higher than, like, a 3.5.
I can say 3.5. I feel good about that.
Yeah, I can also say a 3.5.
I definitely agree that I had more fun reading 89.
And I will say, all of today, and I mentioned this, that after I listened to Baker Street, I had those two songs stuck in my head. All of today at work, I had Down the Apples in Paris stuck in my head. And I can't, I have to own that. That song is catchy as hell. Yeah, okay, so 3.5.
This is going to break my heart. Let's talk about it. Queer subtext. The heart is broken. This is...
Is it the straightest version?
I tried to pull out some moments that feel queer, because I knew we'd get to this, in both. But I think that, like, both of them are about Sherlock opening up to the idea of being with a woman, and they both sideline Watson in a pretty major way.
Yeah.
Watson doesn't get to do much.
Yeah. At the very least, Watson could be said in the 89 one to be, like, a self-deluding queer person because he hates his wife so much, but he stays with her. Like... But in the other one, he's like, I lived my full life with my wife, and now she's gone, but I'm at peace. And, you know, it's the lesser romantic Sherlock than the 89. I think that Baker Street's like a one on queer subtext.
I think Moriarty singing I'll Miss You, Holmes brings it up to a two at least.
I can agree with that, yeah.
I think that's where the queer subtext is in Baker Street, is the Moriarty-Holmes relationship.
Well, right, but we just talked about how he gets sidelined by it, too. So, like, it introduces it, but doesn't do any sort of payoff. Because even Moriarty's not even there at the end. Like, right. You know, I feel like the queerness of that would be that he actually, like, does stick around just to see him suffer or something. Like,
I mean,
I don't know.
I think we understand that he left the record for Holmes to find as a way to taunt him. I think he's saying, like, you're not done with me. I'm still going to be in your life. I think that's part of it.
Okay, I'm willing to go to a two on that one.
Holmes 89.
I mean, there's that one line where he's like, Watson is Watson, and he smells like a walrus or whatever it is. Right. That dance number is really gay. The dance number is really gay.
Which one?
Apples and Pears.
Oh.
It just feels very queer-coded to me, as do all of we didn't even talk about how queer-coded the irregulars are in Baker Street. They're very queer-coded. In the same way that the Newsies are gay, but they're not, like, you know.
The Irregulars are barely in 89, aren't they?
Well, they're just part of the ensemble. Like, yeah. Yeah.
One for 89?
I'd bring it up to two. I think that there's more. Okay, here's the thing. Baker Street gets its queer coding from the Holmes and Moriarty relationship. 89 gets it from the remnants of the Holmes and Watson relationship. There's not much there, but what is there is queer coded.
I'm not getting any, like, this is the first one where I'm like, can we do a negative? Like, I'm not getting at, like, this is,
it's a musical, we can't go negative on queer subtext.
But I'm also looking at what we've done before, and I'm looking at the previous episode that we did, and I'm like, if we gave Get a Clue starring Lindsay Lohan a zero in queer subtext when there was a lot of, like, it was for the girlies and the gays.
Right. We decided from that one that, like, campiness didn't count. It was about a queer reading of the text.
Okay, I see. In that case, 0.5. I don't think there's nothing there. Like, I don't think it's completely scrubbed of the ability to read it as queer coding. But
yes, yeah.
Like, I don't think I can go zero on it, but 0.5 makes sense.
Right, and they won't go all the way. I mean, even that last line, sir or madam.
Yeah.
That is true. Confirmed bisexual icon.
Yeah.
What do you think, Sasha?
Yeah, I'm willing to do a 0.5, but it's going to be a salty 0.5 because you get a clue.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you can... I don't know if you're allowed to retroactively bump Get a Clue up, but was there one more point?
No, that's all of them.
No,
okay. So do we total them all up, or do we...
We do. So, out of 25 for Baker Street, we have a 15.5. And then for Sherlock Holmes 89, it is a 10 out of 25.
So I was so immediately nervous that Baker Street wasn't going to win in those two. Very happy.
Yeah. Zach, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes.
Where can people find you? What do you have coming up next?
Yes. Oh, I can talk about this. Yeah. So on Instagram, I am at Admiral Zach Barr. You can find all about my stuff. Zach-barr.com is also my website. So I usually try to keep that pretty updated with the stuff I'm doing. More relevant to this channel and my, you know, research work is that I have the video essay channel. You can go to youtube.com/@andnowthesing and you'll find my channel with all my recent stuff. Upcoming soon, at the very end of April, I'll be putting out a remastered version of my old video about the two wild parties with a additional like second half of it that is now talking about comparing the Gatsby musicals. Ooh. Which will hopefully be up by the time that the other Gatsby musical opens on Broadway. It's in previews now. It'll open, I think, on the 29th of April. I'll have it up by then. Coming up in August, I will be completing the playwriting residency I'm currently at with Three Brothers Theater. My play Enduring Jest is premiering with that. It's the story of me adapting the book Infinite Jest without reading it.
I love this. I love this project so much.
Thank you. I recently completed, like literally last week as we're recording this, I completed the first draft of it, and I now have to, you know, edit it and make it better. And then the other fun announcement that I can make, which is literally getting announced as we're recording this, is if you're in New York at the very last weekend of July, that is when BroadwayCon happens, I will be at BroadwayCon this year because I am presenting at BroadwayCon this year.
Whoa.
Oh my God.
I am doing a 45-minute talk about, if for those who've watched my Drowsy Chaperone video, static and dynamic art, that terminology that I created. Yes. I am doing a 45-minute explainer on what is static and dynamic art through the lens of Into the Woods, with specifically the defunct Tumblr blog Low Budget Milky Whites. I will be using
yes.
that as my framework to talk about, you know, how each of those, you know, night terrors both is Milky White, like none of them is more Milky White than the other ones, because that's how dynamic art works, as ridiculous as they all are. So I will be in New York at the very end of July, and that will be, I will be filming that and putting that up on the channel for those that can't be there. But if you are going to BroadwayCon, please patronize that, because I, you know, have a very limited reach in New York of people that are going to see that. Oh, and then and I guess in October I'm doing another residency, but I mentioned that at the beginning. Yeah, I have weird stuff coming up all year. As a playwright, I have a lot of really awesome stuff coming up. Like, it's nice to have a, you know, kind of the rest of the year planned out.
Well, we'll have a bunch of links in the description of the episode. We'll put the video channel, of course, your website, and your new Play Exchange page as well.
Yes. Oh, that's also, if you want to, I am on New Play Exchange. The first 5 full-length plays that I've written are all available on there to read for free if you have a New Play Exchange account. If you don't have a New Play Exchange account, just get closer to the mic. Just message me on Instagram and I'll just email it to you. Like, I'm fine with that.
So next week for the mini-sode, we're doing something sort of goofy. We're,
how dare you? This is art. This is important.
This is it.
Next week, we are taking all of the best of the best Sherlocks, and I am compiling them into a drag race simulator.
Excellent.
Oh, shut the up.
And then the week following that, we are finally diving into the Robert Downey Jr. films with Sherlock Holmes. So,
and may the best Sherlock,
thank you,
win.
So we've been your Baker Street regulars.
And we'll see you next time. Bye.